What's the difference between that and a ghost? Sarah was flicking through the pages of Caroline Johnson's diary. They ate early at Highfield, like kids fed their tea at 5 o'clock, and so Sarah had sat cross-legged on the sofa and looked through the case papers while Murray ate his sandwiches. Beats me. I shall haunt you when I'm gone. Don't. Why not? I would have thought you'd be glad to see me. I didn't mean that, I meant... Oh, never mind. Don't talk about dying, he'd meant. He looked out of the window. The sky was clear and sprinkled with stars, and Murray had a sudden memory of lying in the park when he and Sarah first got together, pointing out the constellations they knew and making up names for the ones they didn't. That's the plough, and there's the porcupine. Idiot. Idiot yourself. They had made love on the damp grass, only moving when their empty stomach reminded them they hadn't eaten since lunchtime. Fancy a walk? Murray said now. Once around the block. Instantly, the spark in Sarah's eyes was replaced with anxiety. She drew up her knees to her chest, hugging them close, her fingers gripping Caroline's diary like they were glued to it. It was new, this fear of being outside. Not agoraphobia, not according to her consultant, just another small piece of the anxiety mosaic that was Murray's beautiful, funny, intensely complex wife. No problem. He waved an arm, dismissing the idea and, with it, the hope that Sarah was ready to come home. Small steps, he thought. It was Friday. Christmas wasn't till Monday. There was plenty of time to get her home. Anything leap out at you? He indicated the diary. Slowly, now that he wasn't suggesting she leave the premises, Sarah's muscles began to unwind. She opened the book, looking for a particular date. Did the daughter say anything about a planning objection? Not that I recall. Sarah showed him the page, a month before Caroline had died, on which a reference number had been noted, beneath the reminder, planning objection. People get very het up about planning permission. Het up enough to kill someone? Nowt so queer as folk? Murray brought up the Eastbourne planning portal on his phone and peered at the reference on the diary, tapping it in with his forefinger. It's an application for an extension. He found the applicant's name. Mr. Robert Drake. Murray remembered the list of friends and relatives who had consoled Caroline Johnson the day of her husband's death. He lives next door to Anna Johnson. Murray scanned the summary. It was rejected, although it looks like he's trying again now. There's a linked appeal. You see, there's your motive, Poirot. There were 34 objections. I'd better check they haven't all been bumped off. Sarah raised an eyebrow. Go on, take the piss out of my theories. What's your money on, detective? Murray wasn't a betting man. There were enough variables in life without seeking out more, and the picture around the Johnson investigation was far from clear. Suicide. Think again. Caroline Johnson's suicide was a carbon copy of her husband's, he said, as much to himself as to Sarah. The similarities added weight to the coroner's verdict, not least because of details from Tom Johnson's death that had never been released to the press. The Gazette had run an obituary following Tom's death. The family had been well known locally, the business handed down through 3 generations. They had referred to the personal effects left on the clifftop, the car abandoned in the car park, but not to the rucksack Tom had filled with rocks. The only people privy to that piece of information had been the family, and the woman who witnessed Tom's suicide, Diane Brent Taylor. Murray thought about the anonymous card sent to Anna, the rabbit on their doorstep. He thought about the convenience of a suicide at high tide, leaving no bodies to spill their secrets on the slab. Both Tom and Caroline had researched tide times, but why would it matter to either of them if their bodies were found? It all seemed too convenient, too staged. Sarah took in her husband's thoughtful expression. What is it? I've got no evidence. Instinct first, evidence later. Isn't that what you used to say? Murray laughed. He had worked on that basis for most of his career, and it hadn't let him down yet. He was a long way from knowing exactly how Tom and Caroline Johnson had died, but all his instincts pointed one way. You think she was murdered, don't you? Slowly, Murray nodded. I think they both were. Sarah looked thoughtful. She returned to Caroline's diary, flicking through the bundle of loose flyers and business cards tucked into the back of the book. She picked one up and held it in front of her. I thought you said Mark Hemmings hadn't met the Johnsons. He didn't. They died before he and Anna met. Not according to this. Murray took the flyer Sarah was holding up. Mark Hemmings, Dip ST, Dip STTS, MA Psych, UKCP Accredited, MBA CP. He turned it over. In handwriting he recognized from the many lists in Caroline Johnson's diary was a note. 2:30 p.m., Wednesday the 16th of November. Sarah turned to the relevant page of Caroline's diary, on which the same appointment was noted. She looked at Murray. He's lying. Chapter 22. Anna. At 6, the doorbell rings. I open the door to find Uncle Billy standing there, a bottle of wine in hand. I stare at him blankly. You hadn't forgotten, had you? Of course not. I was miles away. Lovely to see you. I pull him into a hug to hide my lie. Sorry for storming out yesterday. He shrugs off my apology. Heat of the moment. Think nothing of it. Now, where's my gorgeous great-niece? We head for the kitchen, and I give Ella to Billy, who holds her awkwardly, as though he's guessing the weight of a marrow at the county show. She keeps reaching for his nose, which makes him laugh, and the pair of them look so sweet, I pick up my phone and take a quick snap. There's a text from Mark. Running late. Sorry. Kiss. I fire off a quick reply. No worries. Billy here for supper. Kiss. Great. I put my phone away and smile brightly at Uncle Billy. Mark'll be home soon. He's really looking forward to seeing you. Billy's smile doesn't quite reach his eyes. Great. I pour myself a large glass of wine. Pregnancy and breastfeeding have broken the drinking habits created by my parents, but tonight I think I'm going to need this. Dad loved telling the story of how, aged 6 and learning to read a clock, I was tested by friends of my parents who were over for drinks. What time is it, Anna? Wine o'clock, I chimed. I don't remember it. Can't even be sure it wasn't just one of Dad's stories, although it has the ring of truth about it. It's past 7 when Mark gets home, full of apologies and carrying a huge bunch of stargazer lilies. Sorry, he says, as he hands them to me, and I know he's not talking about being late. Me too, I say softly. Good to see you. Mark pumps Billy's hand enthusiastically. I hover beside them, my cheeks aching from the force of my smile. You too. Looking after this one, I hope. Billy, I'm quite capable of looking after myself. Mark winks at me. Let it go. I'm doing my best, Bill. How's business? Never better. As Billy walks ahead of us into the sitting room, Mark shoots me a confused look. I shake my head. Since Dad died, profits have plummeted, and Billy's struggling. Dad's half of the business passed first to Mum and then to me, but I haven't even begun to make sense of it. I told myself maternity leave was the perfect time to sit down and go through everything, to learn how the business works, but I underestimated the demands of a tiny baby. I'm lucky if I get time to read the back of a cereal packet. All I know is the headline figures, and they don't look good. Now isn't the time to call Billy out. I leave Mark fixing drinks and retreat to the kitchen. When I return, the two men are sitting in silence. I rack my brains to think of something Mark and Billy have in common besides me. Oh, tell Billy about Ella dancing, I prod Mark, who looks perplexed. When you put Guns N' Roses on? I pause, but he's still not with me. And we turned around and she was waving and kicking her legs, and it was in time with the music, and she looked like she was dancing. Right, yes, well, that's it, really. Like she was dancing. Billy laughs politely. This is excruciating. It's a relief when the doorbell rings. Mark jumps up, but I get there first. It's like Piccadilly Circus in here tonight, I say brightly. I have never been so relieved to see anyone as I am to see Laura. I just dropped by to see how you were after yesterday. She surveys me. Are you all right? You look a bit manic. I drag her inside and into the kitchen, shutting the door. You have to stay for supper. I can't. I have plans. Laura, please, you have to save me. I love Billy dearly, and I love Mark, obviously, but I'm fast coming to the conclusion that they can't be in the same place at the same time. Are they arguing again? No, but it's only a matter of time. Laura laughs. It'll cost you. I hold up the bottle of wine in one hand, an empty glass in the other. Done. Sure enough, when we walk into the sitting room, the men are in full flow. There was no such thing as mental health in my day. Therapists, counselors, mumbo-jumbo claptrap. You just got on with it. Which is probably why we're seeing such a huge fallout from it now. Do you think World War II pilots called in sick with stress? With depression? I think we're only now starting to understand that bloody snowflakes. I cut in. Look who I found. I present Laura as though she's just jumped out of a cake. Now it's a proper dinner party. Laura, you with us for Christmas, love? Not this year. I've got a boozy lunch booked with some mates. 4 Bridget Joneses and as much Prosecco as we can handle. She grimaces, but I know she's looking forward to it. She slides onto the sofa next to Billy. Talk cars to me. Mine's on its last legs and I don't know what to replace it with. I've got a 3-year-old Skoda I could do a good price on. Laura wrinkles her nose. That wasn't quite the look I was going for. There's an MX-5 that might be more up your street, although it depends on your budget. Tell you what, try a few out for size. Take the Skoda for a day or two, and anything else you fancy, and see how they drive. With the conversation safely steered away from the value or otherwise of Mark's job, I return to the kitchen. Wine blunts the barbed edges of Billy's and Mark's comments, and by the time we've finished eating, I finally relax. I see your neighbours going for planning permission again. Billy is mellow, no longer looking to point score over Mark. I'm grateful to them both. He's made a few changes since he was knocked back. It's a bit less grand designs now. It was the light Caroline was worried about. Laura points to the window, where the outside light illuminates the patio and the fence between our garden and Robert's. It'll completely overshadow your garden. You should put in an objection. I wouldn't want to fall out with Robert. He might be irritating, but he was very kind when Mum and Dad died, and I don't want to cause any awkwardness. The system's there for a reason, Laura says. It doesn't have to get personal. You just fill out a form and say why you oppose the plans. Mark frowns. Maybe we should, Anna. A big extension will make it very dark in here. That could really affect the market value. But we're not selling, I say. I don't care about next door's extension. Mum had an argument with Robert over it when he first applied. Dad had only been gone a month, and Mum's responses to everyday situations were, understandably, a little erratic. When the corner shop ran out of bread, she launched into a verbal tirade that had the poor girl behind the counter shaking. I led Mum away and put her to bed. The girl from the shop was very sympathetic when I went back to apologize. Everyone was. Robert, too. Mum became obsessed by his planning application. She latched onto it like it was a life raft, reading up on conservation areas and listed buildings, and gathering support from other residents in the street. I don't even know how much she really cared about the extension. It was another project for her to get her teeth into, like the fundraising appeal for the Cypriot Dog Rescue Charity, or the Brexit rallies she'd tagged along on. When Mum found a project, she stuck with it. I couldn't have cared less if Robert had been building a football stadium in his back garden. We were dealing with our grief in different ways. We're not selling now, but eventually... Not ever! I pushed my chair back with unnecessary force. The silence that ensues would be uncomfortable, were it not for Ella, snoozing in her bouncy chair, who screws up her face and grunts out a loud and exceptionally noxious fart. Everybody laughs. The moment passes. We should put her to bed, I suppose, Mark says, making no move to do so. Leave her. I don't think it matters where you sleep when you're 2 months old. 2 months already, Billy says. I know, it goes so fast. About time you made an honest woman of Anna, isn't it, Mark? I start clearing the plates. It's not for want of trying. There's no rush, Uncle Billy. We've got a baby together. That's more of a commitment than a wedding ring. I tell you what, Billy says, I reckon a big wedding's just what this family needs, after everything that's happened. His lips are stained purple from the red wine. I'll pay for it. We don't want your money, Bill. Laura sees my face and jumps in. You'd best get yourself on Tinder, Billy, if you're that desperate for a wedding. We'll be your bridesmaids, won't we, Anna? I shoot her a grateful glance. Nice idea, but I don't think there's much of a market for overweight car salesmen past their prime. Oh, come on, Uncle Billy. You're quite the eligible bachelor. Nice house, good business, own teeth. They are your own teeth, aren't they? I leave them laughing and start stacking the dishwasher. The first time Mark proposed was the night I told him I was pregnant. I said no. He didn't have to do that. It's not about having to. I want to. I want to be with you. Don't you want to be with me? I skirted the question. I did. Of course I did. But I wanted him to want me for my sake, not for our babies. He asked twice while I was pregnant, and again just after Ella was born. I almost said yes that time, lying in a post-birth glow, filled with drugs and the euphoria of having created the tiny life that lay sleeping in my arms. Soon, I promised. Like most women, I've imagined my wedding. The identity of the groom has changed over the years, from 6-year-old Joey Matthews when I was in primary school, through a series of unsuitable boyfriends, to a couple of almost suitable ones, but the congregation has remained constant. Friends, Billy, Laura, Mum and Dad. When I think about marrying Mark, all I can think about is who won't be there to see it. It's late by the time Billy and Laura leave. I walk out with them and wave them off, glad of the cold air to clear my wine-filled head. I wrap my arms around myself and stand on the pavement, looking back at the house. I think about Mark's suggestion that we sell up and start afresh, and even though I know he's right, the very thought of leaving Oak View hurts. I glance next door. There are lights on downstairs, and one on what I assume must be the middle landing. The pink planning notice Billy saw is fixed to the gate with plastic cable ties, tiny print explaining the process for lodging a complaint. I suppose there'll be a consultation period, an address for people to write to, should they object to the plans. I can't help but feel there are more important fights to have than whether Robert Drake's extension will block light to our kitchen. Unlike my parents, who seemed at times to thrive on confrontation, the idea of entering into a dispute with a neighbour fills me with dread. Perhaps it's being an only child, with no sibling warfare to toughen me up. But the hint of an argument is more likely to push me to tears than fire me up for retaliation. I'm just walking back to the house when there's a loud crash, and the sound of breaking glass. The night air is disorientating. I can't tell where it came from. As I open the front door, I catch a glimpse of Mark running upstairs. Seconds later, he calls out. I run up the stairs. What is it? What's happened? There's a gust of cold air in Ella's nursery, and the open curtains blow into the room, the glass behind them shattered. I let out a cry. Mark points at her cot. It's covered in shards of glass that glint in the glow from the overhead light, and in the center of the mattress is a brick. An elastic band holds a sheet of paper in place. Gingerly, Mark picks up the brick. Fingerprints, I remember. He holds the paper by a single corner and twists his head to read the typed message. No police. Stop before you get hurt. Chapter 23. Murray. Anna Johnson looked tired. Dark circles ringed her eyes, and although she smiled politely when she opened the door, she had none of the determination Murray had seen in her the previous day. She showed him through to the kitchen, where Mark Hemmings was clearing the table from breakfast. Murray found the dynamic interesting. Despite Anna's obvious strength, when the couple were together, she seemed to let Mark take charge. Murray wondered if this was by choice or by design. Was it Mark who called the shots in this relationship? Had he really lied about not knowing Caroline Johnson? I'm sorry. Am I interrupting? Not at all. We're a bit late getting going today after last night. Last night? There were several wine glasses upturned on the draining board. Murray smiled, wanting to diffuse the tension he didn't fully understand. Ah, a good time had by all? He looked at Anna and then Mark, and his smile faded. Anna was glaring at him, her mouth open. A good time? What the... Mark crossed the room and put an arm around Anna. It's okay. He addressed Murray. Someone threw a brick through our daughter's window, with a note wrapped around it. It could have killed her. Murray got out his notebook. What time was this? Around midnight, Anna said. We were... Mark interrupted. Do we have to go through this again? We were up till 2 a.m. giving statements. It was then that Murray noticed the paperwork on the kitchen table. The card with contact details for the police inquiry center, the victim support leaflet with the phone number ringed in biro. He put away his notebook. No, of course not. I'll check in with the officers who attended and make sure they've got all the information they need. Mark's eyes narrowed. They asked if we had a crime number. Somewhere in the pit of Murray's stomach, he felt a familiar sensation. From the other job, the anniversary card. When Murray had been a probationer, he had cuffed a job that had come back to bite him. The sergeant, a sharp Glaswegian, had hauled Murray into the office to ask why nothing had been done about what seems to me to be an open and shut case, laddie, then promptly assigned Murray to traffic duties. He had stood in the rain, water dripping off his helmet, and felt sick to his stomach. 3 weeks into the job, and he'd already been told off. Was that it? Would his skipper write him off as a bad lot? It wasn't, and the skipper didn't. But that might have been because, from that moment, Murray vowed to treat every victim with the consideration they deserved, and to play everything by the book. He hadn't played this one by the book. Not to worry, he said, as brightly as he could manage. I'll sort that out, back at the station. Why don't we have a crime number? Anna said. She picked up the baby from her bouncy chair and walked towards Murray. You are investigating it properly, aren't you? Metaphorical hand on metaphorical heart, Murray nodded. I assure you I am. Better than if I'd passed it straight to CID, he thought. Nevertheless, the knot of anxiety in his stomach remained, and he wondered if, Even now, someone back at the police station was asking why Murray McKenzie, a retired police officer now working on Lower Mead's front desk, was investigating a possible double homicide. "I wanted to check something, actually," Murray said. He reached into his inside pocket for the leaflet Sarah had found in Caroline Johnson's diary, keeping it inside his hand for the time being. "Mr. Hemmings, you never met Anna's parents." "That's right. I told you that yesterday. It was because of their deaths that Anna came to see me in the first place." "Right. So when you met Anna, that was the first you'd heard of her..." Murray searched for the right word, acknowledging his clumsiness with a sympathetic smile in Anna's direction. "Her situation." "Yes." There was a touch of impatience in Mark's reply. Impatience? Or something else? Something he was trying to hide. Murray produced the flyer. "Is this yours, Mr. Hemmings?" "Yes. I'm not sure I'm following..." Murray handed him the flyer, turning it over as he did so. Curious, Anna moved to see the writing, clearly visible on the reverse. There was a single, sharp inhalation, followed by a look of complete confusion. "That's Mum's writing." Murray spoke gently. "It was found in your mother's diary." Mark's mouth was working, but nothing was coming out. He brandished the flyer. "And what? I don't know why she had it." "It seems she had an appointment with you, Mr. Hemmings." "An appointment? Mark, what's going on? Was Mum a patient of yours?" Anna took a step back, unconsciously distancing herself from the leaflet, from the father of her child. "No, Christ, Anna, I told you. I don't know why my leaflet was with her things." "Right. Well, I just wanted to double-check." Murray held out his hand for the flyer. The younger man hesitated, then dropped it into Murray's open palm with such deliberate lack of direction that Murray was forced to catch it before it fluttered to the floor. Murray smiled politely. "I'll leave you to it, then." "Light the blue touch paper and stand well back," Murray thought as he left the house. Mark Hemmings had some explaining to do. Chapter 24. Anna. "You'd think he'd have known about last night, wouldn't you?" Mark starts clearing the table again, transferring our cereal bowls from table to dishwasher. "The left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. It's ridiculous." He bends to stack the dishes, rearranging what's already there from last night. It crosses my mind that he's deliberately taking his time, deliberately avoiding looking at me. "Did you know my mum?" "What?" He drops our spoons into the rack. 1, 2. "Mark, look at me." He straightens slowly, picks up a tea towel, and wipes his hands, then folds it and places it on the counter. Then he looks at me. "I never met your mum, Anna." If Mark and I had been together for a decade, if we'd met as teenagers, grown up together, I'd know if he was lying, if we'd been through the challenges other couples go through, ups and downs, breakups and makeups, I'd know if he was lying, if I knew him better. His face is unreadable, his eyes unflinchingly on mine. "She made an appointment with you." "Lots of people make appointments with me, Anna. You made an appointment with me. We leaflet drop the whole of Eastbourne, for Christ's sake." He breaks his gaze, turns back to the dishwasher, even though there's nothing left on the side. "But you don't remember speaking to her?" "No. Look, some people book with me direct, others go through Janice. The chances are, I never had any contact with her." Janice sits on reception in the lobby of the office block that houses Mark's Brighton practice, along with a dozen other small businesses that don't need, or can't afford, their own building, their own staff. She manages their diaries, welcomes their clients, and answers the phone, matching her greeting to whichever line is flashing on her phone. Serenity Beauty, can I help you? Brighton Interiors, can I help you? The point is, she never kept the appointment. How do you know? The words don't sound like mine. They're harsh and accusatory. Mark makes a sound like air escaping from a tire. Exasperated. Irritated. It's the first time we've argued. Properly. Like this. Snapping at each other. Turning away to roll eyes at an invisible audience as though trying to summon support. I'd have remembered. You didn't remember she'd booked an appointment. There's a beat before he answers. It'll be on the system. Janice updates it when they arrive. So you can check. I can check. I hand him his mobile. He lets out a short, humorless laugh. You want me to do it now? I wonder if this is what it's like when you think your husband's cheating, if this is what you turn into. I have become the sort of woman I've always despised. A folded arm, pursed lips harridan, demanding on-the-spot answers from a man who has never once given me cause to distrust him. But his leaflet was in my mother's diary. He scrolls through his contacts, taps the entry for the practice. I hear Janice's sing-song tones on the other end of the phone, and know what she's saying, even though I can't hear the words. Holistic Health, can I help you? Janice, it's me. Would you mind checking something on the system? Wednesday, the 16th of November last year, 2:30 p.m., Caroline Johnson. The bravado I felt a moment ago morphs into uncertainty. If Mark were lying, he wouldn't check right now, in front of me. He'd say he needed to look it up at work, or that the records didn't hold that level of detail. He's not lying. I know he isn't. And she didn't rebook. I busy myself picking up Rita's toys and dropping them into the basket. Thanks, Janice. How are the next couple of days looking? Any cancellations? He listens, then laughs. No chance of Christmas Eve off, then. He says goodbye and finishes the call. Now it's my turn to avoid his gaze. I pick up a toy pheasant from which Rita has extracted the stuffing. I'm sorry. She was marked as a no-show. She didn't make another appointment. He crosses the kitchen and comes to stand in front of me, gently hooking his forefinger under my chin and lifting it until I'm looking at him. I never met her, Anna. I wish I had. And I believe him. Because why would he lie? Chapter 25. Murray. Can we go inside now? Murray squeezed Sarah's hand. Let's do one more. They were walking around Highfield, close enough for Sarah to trail a hand along the brickwork, anchoring herself to the building. Okay. Murray heard her breath quicken. She tried to speed up, to get it over with, but he kept the measured pace they had followed for the previous two laps of the building. He did his best to distract her. Tom Johnson's will left the house to his wife, along with his share of the business, and all his assets except for $100,000, which he left to Anna. His life assurance payout went to Caroline. Even though it was suicide. Even though. Murray now knew far more about life assurance and suicide than he had ever needed to know. Most companies had a suicide clause in their policies that meant no payout if the policy had been taken out within 12 months of the policyholder's suicide. It was to stop people committing suicide to escape debt, the helpful woman from Aviva had explained to Murray when he'd rung. Tom Johnson's policy had been in place for years. The payout to his wife made as soon as the death certificate had been issued. What about Caroline's will? Sarah's trailing hand still followed the line of the wall, but now Murray saw air between her fingers and the brickwork. He kept talking. A small sum to her goddaughter, a 10 grand legacy to a Cypriot animal rescue charity, and the rest to Anna. So Anna ended up with the lot. You're sure she didn't bump them both off? Her hand dropped to her side. And send herself an anonymous note. Sarah was thinking. Maybe the card was from someone who knows she killed them. Anna panics, brings the card to the police station because that's what a normal, non-murderous person would do. It's a double bluff. Murray grinned. Sarah was far more creative than any detective he'd ever worked with. Any fingerprints? Several. Nish is working her way through them now. Tom Johnson's car had been dusted for prints after his death, and elimination sets taken from his daughter and the staff at Johnson's Cars. The anonymous card carried full prints from both Anna Johnson and from her uncle, Billy, who had ripped it into pieces before Anna could stop him, and several partials which could have come from anywhere, including the shop where the card had been bought. None of the prints had triggered a hit on the police national computer. At the mention of their friend's name, Sarah had brightened. Her hand relaxed a little in Murray's. How is Nish? She's well. She asked after you. Suggested we have dinner together, when you're up to it. Maybe. Maybe was okay. Maybe was better than no. Tomorrow was Christmas Eve, and Sarah's consultant, Mr. Chowdhury, had decided Sarah should be discharged. Sarah had other ideas. I'm not well, she'd said, worrying at her frayed sleeves. People who proclaimed themselves to be champions of mental health issues were fond of comparing them to physical ailments. If Sarah had broken her leg, we'd all understand that it needed fixing, Murray's line manager had said, when Murray had apologized for taking time off to support his wife. The diversity box had been duly ticked. Only it wasn't like a broken bloody leg. A broken leg could be fixed. X-rays, a plaster cast, perhaps a metal splint. A few weeks on crutches, resting, physio. And then, what? The odd twinge, perhaps, but fixed. Better. Sure, it might break more easily next time you came off a bike, or took the stairs awkwardly and tripped. But it wouldn't snap spontaneously. It wouldn't freeze in horror at the prospect of answering the door, or crumble into pieces if someone whispered out of earshot. Borderline personality disorder was nothing like a broken leg. No, Sarah wasn't well, but she never would be. Sarah, borderline personality disorder is not something we are going to cure. Chowdhury's Oxbridge accent was undercut by a Birmingham twang. You know that. You know more about your condition than anyone. But you are managing it well, and you will continue to do that at home. I want to stay here. Sarah's face had creased into tears. She looked more like a homesick child than a 58-year-old woman. I don't like it at home. I'm safe here. Murray had pasted a smile to his face, to hide the right hook he'd felt to his stomach. Mr. Chowdhury had been firm. You'll be safe at home. Because for the last few days, it hasn't been us keeping you safe. He had paused and leaned forward, pointing steepled fingers towards Sarah. It's been you. You'll continue with daily sessions, then we'll move towards weekly visits. Small steps. The main priority is to get you back home with your husband. Murray had waited for the left hook. But Sarah nodded meekly, and reluctantly agreed that tomorrow she would go home. And then she had surprised Murray by agreeing to go for a walk. Murray stopped. There. That's three. Sarah looked taken aback to see the main door again, their three laps of the building complete. I'll pick you up tomorrow morning. Okay? She frowned. It's group in the morning. Lunchtime, then. Okay. Murray kissed her and began walking down the path to the car park. Halfway down, he turned to wave, but she'd already scuttled inside. Murray spent the next hour tidying the already spotless house, in preparation for Sarah's homecoming. He changed the sheets in their bedroom and made up the spare bed too, putting fresh flowers in both rooms, just in case she wanted to be alone. When the place was pristine, he got in his car and drove into work. The fact that Diane Brent Taylor, The witness who had called the police to report Tom's suicide had not attended the inquest, was troubling Murray. Brent Taylor had claimed she had been on Beachy Head that morning with a lover, and that she couldn't take the risk of her husband finding out where she'd been. CID had tried several times to persuade her, but to no avail. They had no address details for her, just a mobile phone number, and when that had been disconnected, they had given up. This was a suicide investigation, after all. Not a murder. Not then. Murray wasn't going to give up. There were plenty of Taylors and lots of Brents on the police national computer and the electoral register, but no Diane Brent Taylors. Neither did Murray have any joy on open source systems, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, although he would be the first to admit he was hardly an expert in the field. His expertise lay in lateral thinking. He drummed his fingers on the desk, and then started his search again, this time putting a fresh sheet of paper to the side of his keyboard. There was, no doubt, a system that would do this job for him in a fraction of the time, but pen and paper had never failed Murray yet. Besides, taking this to force intelligence would prompt questions he didn't yet want to answer. On the left-hand side of his paper, he jotted down the home addresses of everyone with the surname Brent in a 25-mile radius of Eastbourne. If he had to widen the search, he would, but for now, he was working on the basis that the witness had been local. Next, Murray began a new list of all the addresses occupied by people with the surname Taylor. It was half an hour before he got a match. Bingo. 24 Burlington Close, New Haven. Occupied by a Mr. Gareth Taylor and a Mrs. Diane Brent. Murray looked up with a broad smile on his face. The only person around to see it was John, Murray's dour colleague, who had been confused to see Murray arrive in work an hour previously.
"I thought you were on leave till the new year."
"I've got a few bits to fill in on my PDR."
John's confusion had grown. No one voluntarily worked on their personal development record unless they were going for a new job or prepping for promotion boards. As for doing it in your own time... Now John looked at Murray with complete bafflement.
"I've never seen anyone look so happy to do their PDR." "Just taking pride in my work, John."
Murray whistled as he made his way out of the station. 24 Burlington Close was a quiet cul-de-sac off Southwich Avenue in New Haven, halfway between Eastbourne and Brighton. Murray waited a moment before ringing the doorbell, taking in the carefully tended flower pots around the front door and the "No Cold Callers" sign in the frosted window. A shadow moved towards him as he reached for the white plastic bell, and he realized Mrs. Brent Taylor must have seen him pull up on the drive and been waiting in the hall. She opened the door before the chime had died away. A dog barked from somewhere in the house. Murray introduced himself.
"I'm investigating a case I think you might have had some involvement in. May I come in?"
Mrs. Brent Taylor narrowed her eyes.
"I have to pack for my daughters. It's her turn to do Christmas."
"It won't take long."
She stepped back from the open door.
"I can only give you half an hour."
As welcomes went, Murray had had worse. He smiled and thrust out his hand in a way that made it impossible for Mrs. Brent Taylor not to take it. She glanced around, as if the neighbours might already be passing judgment.
"You'd better come in."
The hall was dark and narrow. There was an umbrella stand and two pairs of shoes on the floor, and an organised pinboard on which Murray could see a variety of leaflets and reminders. Something caught his eye as he passed the board, but he was ushered on into the depths of the house. He was momentarily confused to be directed up a flight of stairs, but his bearings became clear as he reached the top to find a large, open-plan living space and floor-to-ceiling windows with a stunning view of the sea.
Wow.
Diane Brent Taylor appeared at the top of the stairs a full minute after Murray. She seemed mollified by his compliment, the corners of her mouth curling slightly in what seemed to pass for a smile.
"I'm very fortunate."
"Have you lived here long?"
"It'll be 20 years in March. If I move now, It'll be into a bungalow.
She gestured to a mustard-coloured sofa and took the chair next to it. She sank into it with an audible exhalation.
Murray hesitated. He had finessed his line of questioning on the way here, starting with the identity of Mrs. Brent Taylor's lover. After all, it was entirely possible that Brent Taylor had refused to give a statement not just to hide her extramarital activity, but because she, or her lover, had been involved in Tom Johnson's death. Could Diane Brent Taylor have been protecting someone? But now, he felt entirely wrong-footed. Mrs. Brent Taylor was in her late 70s, possibly even in her 80s. She wore the sort of trousers his mother would have described as slacks, teamed with a busily patterned blouse in colours significantly more cheerful than its wearer. Her blue-tinged hair was set in rigid waves, close to her head, and her nails were painted a pale coral. It was, of course, possible that Mrs. Brent Taylor had a lover, but given the time it had taken her to climb the stairs, and the walking stick he had glimpsed propped up behind her armchair, Murray felt it was unlikely she had been gallivanting around Beachy Head with him. Is your husband home?
I'm widowed.
I'm so sorry. Was it recent?
5 years last September. May I ask what this is about?
It was becoming increasingly clear that either Murray had the wrong house or... There was only one way to find out.
Mrs. Brent Taylor, do the names Tom and Caroline Johnson mean anything to you?
She frowned.
Should they?
Tom Johnson died at Beachy Head on the 18th of May last year. His wife Caroline died in the same spot on the 21st of December.
Suicide?
She took Murray's silence as agreement.
How dreadful.
Tom Johnson's death was reported to police by a witness giving your name.
Giving my name?
Diane Brent Taylor.
Well, it wasn't me. I mean, I've been to Beachy Head, obviously. I've lived in or around the area all my life. But I've never seen anyone jump off. Thank God.
She muttered this last to herself. What were the chances of there being two Diane Brent Taylors in the Eastbourne area?
It's an unusual name. It isn't properly double-barreled, you know, Mrs. Brent Taylor said defensively, as though this exonerated her. My husband liked the sound of them together. He thought it went down well on the golf course.
Right. Murray steeled himself. It was already clear that today's excursion had been a wild goose chase, but he wouldn't be doing his job properly if he didn't dot all the I's and cross all the T's.
So, just to clarify, you definitely didn't call 999 on the 18th of May, 2016, to report seeing a man throw himself off the cliffs at Beachy Head.
Mrs. Brent Taylor narrowed her eyes.
I may be getting on a bit, young man, but I still have my full faculties.
Murray just managed to stop himself thanking her for the misplaced compliment. One final thing, and I apologize if this seems a little impertinent. Is it at all possible that on the 18th of May last year, you might have been on Beachy Head with someone else's husband? Within seconds, Murray found himself standing outside 24 Burlington Close, with the door slammed firmly in his face. Really, he thought. Diane Brent Taylor moved quite quickly when she wanted to.
Chapter 26 Anna. Running feet make a pleasing sound on wet tarmac. My trainers feel strange after what must be a year at the bottom of the understairs cupboard, and my leggings cut into the soft flesh around my waist, but it feels good to be moving. Out of the habit, I have forgotten my headphones, but the rhythmic sound of my own breathing is hypnotic. Reassuring. Mark's mum, Joan, has come for Christmas, and as soon as she arrived, early this morning, she and Mark practically press-ganged me into letting her take Ella out.
It'll give her a chance to get to know me.
A little break will do you good, sweetheart.
And don't you dare do housework. You're to put your feet up and read a magazine.
Go back to bed, if you want. Reluctantly, I packed Ella's bag with nappies and expressed milk, issued Joan with a list of instructions I knew she'd ignore, and walked around my house, looking for ghosts. The house was too quiet, the ghosts all in my head. I drove myself mad sniffing the air for Jasmine, screwing shut my eyes in an effort to better hear voices that weren't there. There was no way I'd sleep, or even settle for a few minutes with a magazine, so I went upstairs to put on my running things. The landing was darker than normal, the piece of board over the nursery window blocking out the light. I ran past a parade of shops, colourful lights strung like bunting across the street. Tomorrow is Christmas Day. I wish I could go to sleep tonight and wake up on Boxing Day. Last year, Mum had been dead for 4 days. Christmas didn't happen. No one even pretended to try. This year, the weight of expectation sits heavily on my shoulders. Ella's first stocking, her first time on Santa's knee, our first Christmas as a family. We are making memories, but every one is bittersweet. "Do you have to work today?" I asked Mark this morning. "Sorry. Christmas is a difficult time for a lot of people." "Yes," I wanted to say. "Me." My lungs are burning, and I haven't run more than a mile. The year before last, I did the Great South Run. Now I can't imagine making it to the beach without collapsing. The high street is thronged with harassed shoppers buying last-minute presents. I run into the road to skirt the queue at the butcher's, customers snaking down the road for their turkeys and chipolatas. I haven't been paying attention to my route, but as I turn the corner, I see Johnson's cars at the end of the road. My pace falters. I put one hand on the stitch in my side. On Christmas Eve, Mum and Dad would always shut up shop at lunchtime. They'd lock the doors and gather the staff, and I'd fill sticky glasses with sweet mulled wine, while Billy and Dad handed out the bonus checks, and "I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day" piped through the speakers. I could turn back, take the side street on the left and double back towards home, put Mum and Dad and the police investigation and the smashed nursery window out of my mind for a few more hours. I could. I don't.
"Run, Annie, run!"
Billy is walking across the forecourt. He's pumping his arms as though he's sprinting, and I laugh because he looks ridiculous and he doesn't care. He comes to a halt a few feet away from me and does half a dozen star jumps before stopping abruptly.
"Hope the lads don't put that on YouTube."
He wipes the back of his hand across his forehead.
"Christ, I haven't done that since the Green Goddess was on the box."
"Maybe you should." "YouTube?" I stretch, feeling my hamstring burn as I push down on my extended leg.
"CCTV. Billy gestures vaguely up and around us. "Used to be dummies, but the insurance company insists on real ones now, and trackers on the cars, after..."
He breaks off, reddening. "After two partners in the business made off with brand new cars, abandoning them in the public car park at Beachy Head." "Billy, someone threw a brick through the nursery window last night, just after you left."
"A brick?"
A couple browsing the forecourt look up, and he lowers his voice.
"Christ alive, is Ella okay?"
"She was still downstairs with us. She sleeps with us at the moment anyway, but we could have been changing her, or put her down for a nap, or..." It doesn't bear thinking about. "The police came straight away."
"Do they think they'll be able to find out who did it?"
"You know what they're like."
"We'll do our best, Miss Johnson."
Billy made a dismissive sound. "I'm scared, Billy. I think Mum and Dad were murdered, and I think whoever killed them wants to stop us finding out more. I don't know what to do." My voice cracks, and he opens his arms and wraps me in a bear hug.
"Annie, sweetheart, you're getting yourself in a state."
I pull away.
"Do you blame me?"
"The police looked into your Mum and Dad's deaths. They said they were suicides."
"They were wrong." We look at each other for a second. Billy nods slowly. Then, I hope they know what they're doing this time. I point to a black Porsche Boxster in pride of place on the forecourt. Nice wheels. Picked it up yesterday. Wrong weather for it, of course. Probably won't shift till the spring. But I'm hoping it'll pull in the punters. There's a worried look in his eyes. How bad is it, Uncle Billy? He says nothing for the longest time, and when he eventually speaks, he keeps his eyes trained on the Porsche. Bad. The money Dad left you. Gone. Billy gives a bitter laugh. It paid off the overdraft, but it didn't touch the loan. What loan? Silence again. Billy, what loan? This time he looks at me. Your dad took out a business loan. Trade had been slow for a while, but we were doing okay. You have to ride the rough with the smooth in this game. But Tom wanted to do the place up. Get the lads using iPads instead of carrying clipboards. Smarten up the forecourt. We had a row about it. Next thing I know, the money's in the account. He went ahead and did it anyway. Oh, Billy. We fell behind with the repayments, and then... He stops, but I hear the rest of his story in my head. Then your dad topped himself and left me with the debt. For the first time in 19 months, Dad's suicide starts to make sense. Why haven't you told me this before? Billy doesn't answer. How much is the loan? I'll pay it off. I'm not taking your money, Annie. It's Dad's money. It's right that you have it. Billy turns so he's standing square onto me. He puts his hands on either side of my shoulders and holds me firmly. First rule of business, Annie. Keep the company money separate from your own money. But I'm a director. If I want to bail out the business... It's not how it works. A company needs to stand on its own 2 feet, and if it can't, well, then it shouldn't be in business. He cuts across my attempt to argue. Now, how about a test drive? He points at the Boxster. Our conversation is over. I learned to drive in a Ford Escort. Start with something sensible, Anna. But once I got my license, the sky was the limit. In exchange for valeting every weekend, I'd borrow cars from the forecourt, knowing I risked the wrath of both my parents and Uncle Billy if I didn't bring them back in mint condition. I never developed the same speed gene as my mother, but I learned how to handle fast cars. You're on. The wet roads mean the Boxster's a little tail-happy on bends, and I head out of town so I can open her up. I grin at Billy, enjoying the freedom of a car with no baby seat in the back, a car with no back seats at all. I catch a worried look on his face. I'm only doing 62. Then I understand it's not the speed Billy's concerned about, but the sign for Beachy Head. I hadn't been thinking about where we were going. I'd been enjoying the feel of a responsive engine, of a steering wheel that twitched like a live thing beneath my hands. I'm sorry. It wasn't intentional. Billy hasn't been to Beachy Head since Mum and Dad died. On test drives, he takes people the other way, towards Beck's Hill in Hastings. I glance to the side and see his face, pale and crumpled, reflected in the near side mirror. I take my foot off the accelerator, but I don't turn around. Why don't we take a walk? Pay our respects. Oh, Annie, love, I don't know. Please, Uncle Billy. I don't want to go on my own. There's a heavy silence. Then he agrees. I drive to the car park where Mum and Dad left their cars. I don't need to look for ghosts here. They're all around us. The paths they trod, the signs they passed. I last came on Mum's birthday, feeling closer to her up here than in the corner of the churchyard where 2 small plaques mark my parents' lives. The cliffs look the same, but the questions in my head have changed. No longer why, but who. Who was Mum with that day? What was Dad doing up here? Suicide? Think again. Okay?
Billy nods tightly.